Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing concern that Trump is becoming unhinged following Wednesday's rambling diatribe on the South Lawn of the White House, where he looked up to the heavens and declared himself the chosen one. One of the first to sound the alarm about Trump, Lance Dodis, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and is a contributor to the book Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, joins us to discuss how Trump's recent pronouncements show his cognitive abilities are deteriorating. While it is clear Trump's extreme narcissism is such that this empty man does not love anyone but himself and has no real relationship with people, his need to be all-powerful and all-loved and the fact that he can't stand being challenged is becoming dangerous since he thinks of himself as a dictator and it's all about him and no one else matters. Furthermore, with Trump in this psychotic-like state, the more he is pressed and you challenge him, the more it becomes apparent how disorganized and empty he is. And when that emptiness is exposed, he flies into a disorganized rage, which, given his role as commander-in-chief, could be catastrophic. Then, with Brazil's major cities choking from smoke-filled air due to fires in the Amazon, which the country's dim-witted fascist leader blames on NGOs, we will speak with journalist and author Alexander Zaitchik, who recently returned from Brazil and wrote the investigative piece for The Intercept and the Pulitzer Center, Rainforests on Fire, on the front lines of Bolsonaro's war on the Amazon, Brazil's forest communities fight against climate catastrophe. Then finally, with Trump heading for the G7 meeting in France after making a pitch to have Russia readmitted to the G8, we'll discuss our president's slavish fealty towards Putin, who he continually wants to reward by lifting sanctions, which the rest of the G7, Japan, Germany, Britain, France, Italy, and Canada oppose. Stephen Pfeiffer, who served as the United States Ambassador to Ukraine and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council, joins us to discuss how the popularity in Russia of Ukraine's new leader, the Jewish servant of the people, who is dismantling the power of the oligarchs, has Putin rattled. And joining us now is Lance Dodis, a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He's the author of The Heart of Addiction, Breaking Addiction, A Seven-Step Handbook for Ending Any Addiction, and The Sober Truth. And Dr. Dodis is a contributor along with 36 other psychiatrists and mental health experts who have contributed to the new book, Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, updated and expanded with new essays. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lance Dodis.
Hi, Ian. It's good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Dodis. And I spoke yesterday with the journalist who writes for the New York Times and for special correspondent for Vanity Fair. He did an interview with the former short-lived communications director of the White House, Anthony Scaramucci, otherwise known as the Mooch, who he's known for years on Wall Street. And as you probably know, Scaramucci is trying to organize Republicans to find a good Republican candidate to challenge Trump in the primaries. And Scaramucci and others, he says, inside the White House can think that Trump is becoming increasingly unhinged. Scaramucci says that soon some of these White House insiders are going to go public with how dangerous and deranged he behaves on the inside. And I've always felt that that was the really, at the end of the day, if you could get a camera inside the Oval Office and just see how this man operates in, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, the scales would come off the eyes of the entire country and this nightmare would be over. Do you think we will reach that point where Trump will be exposed for who he really is? Or do you think he might have a public meltdown?
That's a good question. I think I suppose it's 50-50. I don't know enough about what's going on inside the White House to know what their chances are of doing that. That would be better. That would be better than the public meltdown, because the more publicly humiliated he is, and of course he's easily humiliated because of who he is, the more likely he is to fly into one of these, as you said, unhinged rages. And then no one knows what he would do next. The sky is the limit. Given that he, I like your summary, by the way, so given that he literally does not care about other people, he doesn't respect them, he doesn't have any sense of their having independent wishes that need to be considered, he's anti-democratic, not in the small d sense. I mean, democracy means nothing to him because he doesn't appreciate the value of anyone else. It's all him. Given all of that, if he is pressed maximally from outside, we don't know what he would do. I've said for a long time that one of my biggest worries is that he'll start a war. You know, it'll be like Remember the Maine or one of the other pretexts for starting wars that we know throughout history. Something will happen. He'll say, we must gather around your God, that's him, and go to war. If that doesn't happen, you know, maybe, as you say, maybe something good would come of it. And finally, the people who blindly see him as, they do see him as a godlike figure, like a cult leader, maybe they would finally see their way through. And more importantly, maybe then the people in Congress who support him would finally realize that their political futures will come to an end unless they get him out of office.
So is there a psychiatric explanation for, you know, Trump's going to the, this weekend he'll be in Biarritz in France at the G7 summit. And we already know that he's been trying to get Putin accepted back into the G7, make it the G8 again. He shows enormous fealty to Putin, and he does the same with Xi Jinping. He just, and the North Korean, the hideous, murderous dictator, Kim Jong-un. So is the reason why he can't stand being with his peers, the European leaders, that he knows they think he's an idiot? Is that what upsets him and why he trashes them all the time? Whereas with these dictators, one, it indulges his sense of that he wants to be like them. But two, they flatter him because they want to take advantage of him.
I think you said it exactly right. I think there are several pieces to it. When you describe the other Western leaders as his peers, that's the problem for him. He has no peers. He doesn't want peers. There's no such thing. He wants people who worship him. So they don't worship him, and therefore they are enemies. So he attacks them. He attacks our allies because, remember, again, it all comes down to the fact that everything is about him, not the country. So the fact that they are allies of the United States is irrelevant. They are not allies and supporters of Donald Trump, so he's against them. And I think you're also right with the dictators like Putin. He sees in them a common personality type. It's like he admired Mussolini, you may remember. He sees in them people like himself and that he would like to join, because in his mind those are powerful, important people that are what he values. And they are smart enough to know how to deal with him. You're right. They are taking advantage of him. They may have things on him, as was speculated. It wouldn't be a shock. There's so much that you could have on him. If the Russians had background opposition material on Hillary Clinton, they surely have it on Donald Trump, because there's much more of it. So that may be a piece of it, too. But he's playing a game in which Donald Trump is the player and the potential winner. It has nothing to do with the United States.
And again, I'm speaking with Lance Dodis, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and he is a contributor along with 36 other psychiatrists and mental health experts who have contributed to the new book, Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. So one of the things that Scaramucci, the Mooch, is predicting is that, along with saying that which you were saying on MSNBC last night, Lance Dodis, that you can detect that his sort of cognitive faculties and abilities are deteriorating. That's what also both the what was her name, Omarosa, who was in the White House from the beginning with him, and then they had finally parted company along with Scaramucci, that they've detected that. But Scaramucci says, and I understand that there is something in psychiatry called narcissistic mortification, and that is that he thinks, the Mooch thinks that sometime like March of next year, Trump will see the writing on the wall that he's not going to win the presidency, even if Putin helps him fiddle the results. It still won't be enough if there's going to be a blowout against him, and that he will quit. Do you see that as a possibility?
Well, that in one way that would be nice, but leaving that aside, it's a possibility. It's like Nixon having peace with honor, you know. It's a way to do what you need to do and find a way to pitch it. Maybe he could.
But the idea being that he cannot face humiliation. So that
right.
That's like garlic to and a cross to Dracula. You know, yeah, a vampire, yeah. Right?
Yeah, no, that's right. He would find another way out. I agree with that. The only other thing I would say is the cognitive issue is a little different. It may be also true, but there are two separate issues here. What I was saying on MSNBC and what I've said before is not about his cognitive function, even though I agree it has declined. But his problem is actually lifelong. In this way, he is no worse, but he was terrible to begin with also. It's that he has a character disorder, what we call a personality disorder. This is who he is. He's a sociopath. And that has been unchanged throughout his life. And if you look back through his life, that's every sign of it has always been present. He has always been a racist. He has always cheated people. He's always lied, so forth. He's never, he does bad things to people, and he doesn't care. That has always been true. I don't think that it's actually more true, but I think that he has, by becoming president, he has reached a point where he can no longer bully his way to have whatever he wants. So that's why it was predictable when he became president that he would get worse, because unlike Hitler and the Weimar Republic, he can't just roll over everybody here. And he's faced with what he absolutely cannot stand. So, yeah, no. He could quit. Of course, if he quits, then we've got Pence, but that's a separate issue.
Right, but I think one of the problems that would feed his addiction of narcissism would be being the president. You know, everybody steps and fetches for you.
Yeah.
You're just treated like a god. You know, your whole life is surrounded by servants and sycophants.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, that's why he sought the job to begin with. But part of his problem is that there is no way to completely fill the emptiness inside of him. It doesn't matter. He would have to, in a different universe, he would become the dictator of America, following which he would become the dictator of the entire world, and even that wouldn't be enough because the emptiness is inside. I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but it's true. So he was able to get away with it for a long time, I gather, in his own business where he was a dictator, and when things failed, when he went bankrupt multiple times, he could just leave the people whose money he had lost and start again and deny that there was any problem. But now he's in a position where that's harder to do. Your idea about having him quit makes sense in that context. What can he do? He can't acknowledge that he was wrong or that he failed. So, yeah, he would declare that he had been driven out by the immigrants and the fake news. And he would then go off to fund his own party, basically, which he already has, and continue to have as much influence and as much money as he could.
Well, Lance Dodis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure.
And again, I've been speaking with Lance Dodis, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And he is a contributor along with 36 other psychiatrists and mental health experts who have contributed to the new book, Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. Even if he had to wrong someone, I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. Even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Alexander Zaitchik, who is a journalist and the author of Common Nonsense, Glenn Beck and the Triumph of Ignorance, and The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. He recently returned from Brazil, where he wrote the investigative piece at The Intercept and Pulitzer Center, Rainforest on Fire, on the front lines of Bolsonaro's war on the Amazon, Brazil's forest communities fight against climate catastrophe. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Zaitchik.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Alexander. And the president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, at a press conference today suggested that the fires in Brazil were caused by non-governmental organizations, NGOs. He said that without providing any evidence. There's been an increase of 85% this year in fires across Brazil, and the smoke is so bad that it's choking many cities in Brazil. So it is a catastrophe, and yet what's your sense from having just been there and written a very powerful piece, which obviously I want to talk to you about? Is there any way to stop this guy?
Just to get to the first part of your question, one of the things I was struck by when I was in Western Brazil a couple of months ago, where many of these fires are taking place now, was the sense that everybody knew this was coming, because the fires that we're seeing now are the end of a process that began earlier in the year during the dry season with the cutting and the clear cutting of the forest. And they were waiting for the conditions to ignite these fires. And the world really wasn't interested in listening to the indigenous communities who were watching this take place, who were, you know, screaming for help. And they were trying to warn people that this is exactly what was about to happen. So now the world's attention is turned to the Bolsonaro regime and what's taking place, which is a good thing. Unfortunately, you know, it would have been nice if this attention had been a little bit sooner, because things are very well underway at this point. And as a lot of the scientists who've been quoted in the last couple of days have mentioned, we're nearing a tipping point with the entire Amazon region. And putting a cap on this is incredibly urgent. How to do that with this government in place is, you know, the big question. I don't know exactly what mechanisms exist. You know, he doesn't seem very susceptible to foreign pressure. If anything, he, you know, doubles down when the outside world rattles his cage. He says, you know, this is a Brazilian issue. This is Brazilian territory. The outside world has nothing to do with what we do with our forests and our rivers. And, you know, one notable thing about his recent comments was when he said, you know, they're trying to shame us, the NGOs and the outside world, which is interesting because until now, he didn't even seem to think there was any shame in burning down the Amazon rainforest. So if nothing else, there has been a slight wrinkle in his, you know, framing of this, but it's not clear exactly what levers of power can be used. Trade is obviously a big one that people are talking about, but, you know, the EU and Asia is actually, they're actually signing trade pacts for Brazilian beef. You know, there's not a whole lot of momentum in the needed direction so far. So it looks like we're starting from a pretty much a place of, you know, we're starting at zero.
Sure, and obviously rational arguments may not penetrate this man, but the truth of the matter is that it's not a Brazilian issue. It's a global issue because, as it's often said, the Amazon are the lungs of the earth. And your article, Rainforests on Fire, Alexander Zajcik starts out by pointing out that the Amazon is roughly the size of Australia. It exhales a fifth of the earth's oxygen, stores centuries of carbons, and 20% of the world's fresh water cycles through its rivers, plants, soils, and airs. And since in this last half century, about one-fifth of this forest, or some 300,000 square miles, has been cut and burned in Brazil. And now it's being accelerated. And how do you make it a global issue since, you know, he's obviously using nationalism as an excuse for the plunder. But on the other hand, you've got the Arctic melting. All of the indicators are that the very things that prevent global warming from becoming a total catastrophe, one by one, they seem to be undermined. And the one that we're talking about here is, it seems, something that we could do something about, right?
Yeah. It is impossible to overstate how critical the Amazon is, both as a carbon sink, but also as a regulator of global flows of, and production of oxygen and fresh water. You know, rain throughout the Western Hemisphere is regulated in large part through evapotranspiration in the Amazon. It is essential that we get a handle on this, and we can, we know we can because we have in the past. I mean, the last time we saw fires of this magnitude was in the 1980s, the late 1980s and into the mid-1990s, when the first civilian government after the military junta that ran Brazil for two decades was trying to get a handle on the situation. And they developed mechanisms and agencies and enforcement tools that actually did slow and eventually stop the runaway deforestation of the late 20th century. And only now is that being uncorked again. So we know it's possible. We know how to do this. What we need is a government that understands the historic importance of doing so. And unfortunately, we have the exact opposite in this Skyball scenario and his coterie. And his supporters, of course, the so-called ruralistas in parliament and the farming bloc and the agribusiness industry. You know, we just need to survive this this government and get back to someone like Lula, who actually did. He wasn't great. He wasn't perfect. But had he not been thrown in prison in what was essentially, you know, a corrupt extra-legal process, then he might be in a position to move us forward. And hopefully another government will be again soon. And we're just going to have to get through this. And the world's going to have to get its act together and exert as much pressure as possible on the Brazilian government.
And again, I'm speaking with Alexander Zajcik, who's a journalist and author of Common Nonsense, Glenn Beck and the Triumph of Ignorance, and The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. He recently returned from Brazil, where he wrote the investigative piece at The Intercept and the Pulitzer Center, Rainforest on Fire, on the front lines of Bolsonaro's war on the Amazon, Brazil's forest communities fight against climate catastrophe. So let's focus on Bolsonaro and his constituency and the far-right political traditions in Brazil. He's a reincarnation of these military dictatorships in effect. What is their justification for this kind of plunder? There's a kind of confluence of agribusiness, cattle barons and ruralistas, as you call them, and I guess just regular sort of subsistence farmers who just go there and just throw some gasoline into the forest and clear the land and create what you refer to as a green desert.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the irony here is most Brazilians get nothing from this, and in fact might have much more to benefit from protecting the forest. But the average Brazilian, even the people who are paid to cut down the trees and clear the land for cattle, you know, are very small players in all of this. And it's basically to the benefit of these large operations and a few very wealthy people. And it's driven by this ideology of development and industrialization and this idea that the Amazon is this kind of wasted resource unless it's used. And you know, it is there for the, you know, modernization and greater glory of this sort of idea of Brazil, which is really an idea of the coasts and the cities where most Brazilians live and where sort of this Brazilian nationhood concept has always been sort of developed in opposition to this sort of wild, dangerous, indigenous inhabited blank that is the Amazon. And there's also an undercurrent of anti-indigenous racism involved. So it's complicated. But yes, as you note, there's this long tradition of far right, almost antagonism towards this part of the country, this fear of it, both as a place that is not Christian and not safe, but also as a place that is open to foreign subversion, a place that the rest of the world covets, that is going to invite foreign intervention, foreign subjugation, that armies are going to march across the border and claim it for themselves. And it's taken different forms over the years, but now it's this idea of like the UN, Western governments, NGOs forming this unholy alliance that has Brazilian sovereignty in its sights, and the banner is climate emergency, but they don't think that's real. So it's all just an excuse to take Brazil's resources. So it's a long and kind of tangled history that Bolsonaro is the latest iteration of, but he's a particularly blunt force and not terribly bright version of that history. It's unfortunate, to say the least, that we're still dealing with that.
So let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned, Alexander, how during Lula's regime, at least they tried to hold the line. And of course, there was a judicial coup against him, which has been exposed now as a total fraud. And the judges turned out to have been working with the conspirators. And but if you go back a bit, there was, of course, the famous rubber tapper and union leader, Chico Mendes, who was often referred to as the Gandhi of the Amazon. He was assassinated in 1988. My understanding is that the reserve that he protected is now under assault.
Yeah, it is. Times have changed, and a lot of the children of the comrades of Chico Mendes from that period are now tempted by the short-term gains offered by the cattle industry. Rubber is, subject to international market whims. So, right now it's not a great business to be in. And there's just the general sort of lure of modernity, consumerism, that is constantly sort of tugging at a lot of these communities. Unfortunately, that's part of the story in Acre, which is the Western Amazonian state where Chico Mendes launched his revolution, which is still in the DNA of Brazil and has a huge impact in the current story, because all of these reserves that are supposed to be protected were a result of Mendes' ideas, and they were adopted in the civilian constitution in 1988. And Bolsonaro basically came into office saying he did not respect these reserves or the ideas behind them or their goals, and basically gave the green light for the people that coveted that land to just go in and start cutting. And now we're seeing the burns that resulted from those cuts.
And Bolsonaro has already decimated the government institutions that protected the land, has he not?
Yeah, all of the agencies that had been built up and put into place, IBAMA being the most important, the Environmental Protection Agency, and has a pretty serious enforcement arm. It has been gutted. They've been held back. They've been de-staffed. They have, offices in the regions that are just empty. The president has made remarks that have emboldened extra-legal attacks on them and their staff. It's a really scary situation where the government has basically declared parts of its own bureaucracy to be like the enemy of the people almost. And these are the groups that were not only protecting the land, but were also assisting indigenous communities and other forest communities in protecting their rights as enshrined in the Constitution and international conventions. So the indigenous communities on the front lines, who are a buffer between development and the last tracts of rainforest, are completely on their own. And they feel abandoned, and they know the risks that they face. But it's incredibly inspiring to spend time with them, because they have no intention to stop fighting and trying to save their territories.
So, Alexander, when you say that the Brazilian people do not benefit from the destruction of this massive rainforest that's often referred to as the lungs of the earth, which is so important to the rest of the globe, particularly as we've got something like 10 years to do something to reverse global warming, otherwise we're going to reach the point of no return. And this does seem to be on the surface one area that could be dealt with. But if the idea is that nobody in Brazil necessarily benefits from it, then who does benefit from it?
Well, you have a strata of barons and managers that run these cattle operations, that run these soy operations. But, you know, for the most part, the wealth generated accrues among a small number of people. I mean, these regions, I've traveled to them pretty extensively. And like all of Brazil, there's an extremely high rate of poverty. And there's not a lot of jobs being created. I mean, this is just land being cleared. You know, mostly for animals to be slaughtered and shipped abroad, and the profits go to these mega concerns and their middlemen. But it's not generating some sort of like thriving middle class. It's not really lifting anyone out of poverty. And you know, the precondition for any sort of growth worth speaking of is, of course, a living planet with breathable air, not like the soot filled air that people in Brazil's largest city were recently breathing, are breathing. And, you know, the science, the economics of what a healthy forest could produce if managed well and sustainably and intelligently is really quite provocative. I mean, there is a lot that can be done with a healthy rainforest that can generate money in a lot of different ways that does not require cutting down trees. I mean, the amount of plant and animal life and unknown riches that the Amazon stores, you know, it's tantalizing, but also it's horrifying to think about the opportunity cost of losing, you know, God knows what medicines or future cures could be lurking in these forests that are now burning.
So along with cattle, and obviously that gets down to whether, I don't know whether this beef ends up in McDonald's, but what happens with the soybeans? Because they also, aren't they tearing down the forest to grow soybeans? And are some of the multinationals like DuPont, Dow DuPont, Bayer, Monsanto, and Cargill, are they in there as well?
My understanding of the soy industry is it's mostly Brazilian firms. Uh-huh. And their biggest markets are the EU and Asia. Uh-huh. Although the US obviously gets some of the soy. And the soil in the Amazon is not great for anything, any kind of farming really. So it requires this constant use of heavier and heavier pesticides and chemicals to keep it going. And then, of course, when the soil does give way and dry out, then they have to cut down more trees. So it's not like it's sustainable process. It requires more and more land in the end game. Even just to maintain the current level of soy production and cattle production is no more forest left. So it's not something that can just be, you know, you can't just draw a line around it and say, well, just keep this much cattle industry and this much soy, because the soil is constantly dying and requiring new land.
Right, and that's why you call it the green desert.
Yeah, after a while, you know, it just turns into this semi-arid savanna, like the Cerrado in the south of the country. And that's what the possible future of the Amazon is. There's two tipping points. One would be a 4 degrees Celsius global temperature rise, and the other one would be a 20% loss of forest cover. And science seems to indicate that would trigger a cascading collapse, and the Amazon would basically turn into one big savanna, semi-arid savanna.
So just in closing, is there a possibility of NGOs, which Bolsonaro is blaming on these fires, getting together with all the indigenous groups, the Western governments, and the UN, using the climate emergency? And as we talked about earlier, you know, it is, as much as Bolsonaro says this is a Brazilian sovereignty issue, it's not, because this is the lungs of the earth and the whole planet needs this oxygen. And I mean, maybe there's some kind of quid pro quo here. Can you do something to substitute for the plunder? Can you just, you know, can we all sort of chip in and find a way not to have this rampant greed that doesn't benefit anybody but a few cattle barons?
Well, I mean, there have been some efforts in that direction. The Norwegians have kind of taken the lead on trying to fund alternatives and keep deforestation in check. Bolsonaro has been antagonistic towards those initiatives. He doesn't seem to care about the $1 billion rainforest fund that Norway set up, and that's now in jeopardy. But I think you suggest one avenue that has to really be talked about, even though it's not easy or simple, and that is addressing the root causes of all of this, which is a world economy based on just rampant consumption and not very intelligent consumption at that. And at some point, we cannot escape having a conversation about values and what kind of society we have and what kind of economy we're going to build. And that's another thing the indigenous communities have been trying to tell us for a long time, that you can't really separate this problem from the much more difficult and ultimately spiritual conversation about who we are and what we're on this planet about and what we're living for.
Well, Alexander Zajcik, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alexander Zajcik, who's a journalist and author of Common Nonsense, Glenn Beck and the Triumph of Ignorance, and The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. He recently returned from Brazil, where he wrote the investigative piece at The Intercept and Pulitzer Center, Rainforest on Fire, on the front lines of Bolsonaro's war on the Amazon, Brazil's forest communities fight against climate catastrophe. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
E ao pensar no projeto, começa a se perguntar: onde é que vamos morar?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Pfeiffer, who's a non-resident senior fellow in the Arms Control and Non-Proliferation Initiative, the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence, and the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution, and the William J. Perry Fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
So what did you make of the extraordinary performance of President Trump yesterday in the Rose Garden in an impromptu press conference with a helicopter whirring in the background? He said all kinds of strange things. He attacked the Prime Minister of Denmark being a nasty woman. He looked up at the heavens and said he was the chosen one. But he did also suggest that Putin should be readmitted to the G7, making it the G8. And he basically said that Putin outsmarted Obama. But I couldn't figure out what he was saying. I mean, what, by invading Crimea and starting a war with Ukraine, somehow you outsmarted Obama? What do you think he was saying there?
Well, that's hard to understand. I mean, it's been very clear over the last 2 years that President Trump has this obsession, this fixation on President Obama. But what we saw and how it affected the G7 and the G8 was not Putin outsmarting Obama, but it was Russia's use of military force against Ukraine.
Well, but the broader issue is the history of Europe in the 20th century was one of countries invading other countries, and this was a red line that nobody wanted to see crossed, right?
Exactly. I mean, this was the most blatant land grab in Europe since World War II. And you know, what you saw, I mean, in the aftermath of the Maidan Revolution in Ukraine, you saw Russian special forces lead the charge for a Russian seizure of Crimea, even though on multiple occasions between 1991 and 2014, Russia had formally recognized that Crimea was a part of Ukraine. So you had that seizure in March of 2014. Russia annexed Ukraine, or annexed Crimea, and that's what led to the other members of the G7, everybody except for Russia, saying it's not appropriate for the next summit to take place as scheduled in Sochi, Russia. And so since then, since March of 2014, the G7 have suspended Russian participation and met as the G7, not as the G8.
And meanwhile, or since then, there's been a low-intensity war in the east of Ukraine, costing a lot of lives and a lot of pain in the economy of Ukraine. And, of course, there was also the shoot down of a passenger airliner, a Malaysian airliner. I think about 300 innocent civilians were killed. It was done by the Russians, no question about it. And yet, all the while, President Trump keeps trying to get these sanctions lifted. He keeps trying to reward Russia while the European Union and the rest of the world is punishing them for what they did in terms of invading a country. So what's going on with Trump? I mean, seriously, there's got to be some subtext here. At this point, it's so blatant. And here he is now, again, going to bat for Putin.
Well, no, this is the odd thing, is that in March of 2014, the G7 suspended Russian participation because of Russia's seizure of Crimea. That didn't cause the Russians to back off. In fact, the Russians doubled down. And you had Russian and Russian proxy forces then impose this conflict in Donbas in eastern Ukraine, which has now claimed well over 13,000 lives. And that conflict continues to simmer with no sign at all that Moscow wants to find a solution to that, end the fighting, end the killing, and restore that part of eastern Ukraine back to Ukrainian sovereignty. So it's odd when President Trump yesterday says it's now the time to bring Russia back into the G8, because Russia has done nothing that the other G7 leaders asked of Russia to get back into the G8. I think it would send a horrible signal to the Russians that Western threats, you know, can be ignored. Although it seems to me that there is some good news, is if you look at other statements coming from the leaders of Germany, Britain, and France, all members of the G7, and also the head of the European Union, which also participates in the G7, they have all made clear that there should be no return of Russia, no restoration of the G8 until Russia makes progress in ending its conflict with Ukraine. So if President Trump is going to head to Paris or head to France this weekend for the G7 summit, thinking that he can make the argument to bring Putin back in, I believe he's going to face an uphill battle.
Well, the White House has already suggested that there won't be a vote on the idea of readmitting Russia.
Which is good, because President Trump would lose on that.
Right. Well, again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pieper, non-resident senior fellow at the Arms Control and Non-Proliferation Initiative, the Center for the 21st Century Security and Intelligence, and the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. And he's also the William Perry Fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. And he served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President, Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. So, I'm speculating about, and a lot of people are actually, about what it is. What hold does Putin have over Trump? Why does Trump go out of his way to keep trying to reward Putin? He slow walks all the sanctions. Now he's trying to undo and just literally forget that Ukraine and Crimea happened. It is strange. And without being conspiratorial, do you have any ideas about what it is that
Putin has over Trump. That appears to be the situation. And it was very evident to everybody that watched the press conference in Helsinki after they met.
Now, I think there are a couple things at work here. And again, I'm not sure whether there's some magic wand that Vladimir Putin holds over Donald Trump. But one is, you've seen this consistently in the last 2.5 years, is President Trump seems to admire and respect much more than other leaders authoritarians. Look how he addresses Putin. Look how he addresses President Xi of China. Look how he talks about Chairman Kim of North Korea. You know, the European leader that he seems to have the most respect for is Viktor Orban, who's taken Hungary in a more authoritarian course. So he seems in general to be, you know, he, and maybe it's because he sees these as strong leaders, you know, he's very reluctant to criticize them. That's one point. The second point is there was a lot of talk that when President Trump came into office, that there were people around him, including his first national security advisor, General Michael Flynn, who thought that somehow you could pry Russia away from both China and Iran. And I think that probably had appeal for President Trump. If you could somehow separate Russia from Iran, that would make the Middle East situation easier to deal with. And if you could somehow separate Russia from China, you know, that would make confronting China, which is the second rising superpower now, that would make that problem more manageable. But in both cases, it was unrealistic. I mean, there was no way that President Trump was going to be able to pull Russia away from China and make China or make Russia a partner in somehow trying to contain growing Chinese influence. Likewise, the Russians have made very clear that they have a relationship with Iran, and there was no way that the United States was going to somehow destroy that relationship and bring Russia in on the side of pressuring Iran. But it seems to me that maybe President Trump still has these hopes, even though they've been utterly disproven by the reality of the last 3 years. And that may be one reason why he still hopes that there can be some magic arrangement with President Putin. I think that's a mistake. Again, we see a president who remains reluctant to criticize Putin directly, remains reluctant to criticize Russian actions, and trying to figure out exactly what's behind that is not easy.
And on top of that, because he doesn't even ask Putin or challenge him to tell the world what happened with that nuclear accident that remains. I mean, we all remember what happened with Chernobyl, and there's been a very effective miniseries on HBO about that. So there again, our president doesn't seem to be using his authority to, you know, get Putin to own up about what's going on.
Yeah, and I think in the end it's self-defeating, because I don't believe that Vladimir Putin respects Donald Trump. When he meets with President Trump and President Trump fails to raise things that he should be raising, like Russian interference in the U.S. election, Russian misbehavior in Ukraine, I don't think that President Putin walks away with respect for Trump. I think he looks at Trump and says, this is somebody I can play, this is somebody I can manipulate. So the reluctance of President Trump to call Russia out on policies and actions where Russia should be called out, you know, his reluctance to do that, I think, in fact, has the effect of even further lowering Putin's respect for him.
Well, Putin, though, seems to be in a little bit of trouble at home. These are demonstrations that have been taking place that have met with a massive police response. The most recent one was an authorized one, or at least it wasn't a banned one, and it was pretty impressive. And these are not, these are middle class professional people and the young. And there was a poll that's quite disturbing that says something over 40% of young Russians want to emigrate. They just don't see a future with Putin and the Siloviki, his cronies who are stealing the country blind. And it's kind of a mafia-style economy. And it's, you know, not unlike, you know, next door in Ukraine, who was run also dominated by oligarchs. But then this guy comes out of nowhere, the servant of the people, a guy that had a TV show of that name, Servant of the People. He suddenly gets elected. And this, I'm talking about Zelensky, and apparently Zelensky's penetrating Russia. People, the Russian people are saying, "My God, look, you know, there's a regular guy. He's an honest guy. He's trying to clean up and get rid of these thieves." And the common word in Russia for United Russia, Putin's party, is the party of thieves and swindlers. And United Russia ran in the city elections in Moscow. Their candidates, they wouldn't even run them under the banner of United Russia. They had to put them under a bunch of phony names. Something's going on there, and my understanding is that Zelensky's has got Putin rattled.
I think that's right. I mean, Putin at home faces a fundamental challenge, and it's not yet clear that he's figured out how to deal with it, which is that he has a situation where the economy is stagnant. In fact, I think there's even some speculation that the Russian economy may go into recession by the end of the year. So he's not delivering the economic goods and the rising living standards that he was able to deliver in his first two terms as president between 2000 and 2008. And the sorts of reforms that he would have to make to open that economy up would, I think, entail a loosening of political control, which he's reluctant to do. And so it's not clear how Putin solves that problem at home. And then he has this new challenge, which has emerged in the form of Volodymyr Zelensky, the new president of Ukraine. You know, first of all, Zelensky, as a movie star, was actually quite popular in Russia. He's a known quantity to Russians, and he's known as a, you know, in a positive way, as a comic and as an actor. Second, Zelensky, although he speaks Ukrainian, also says, "I'm prepared to speak Russian." Zelensky is Jewish. So Zelensky's election negates a big part of the official Russian narrative about what happened in Ukraine in 2014, that this was a neo-Nazi, neo-fascist junta. But then the country went and elected a Ukrainian Jewish president. You know, that this, that the, that their leadership there is virulently anti-Russian. You know, Zelensky speaks Russian and actually has talked about reaching out to the ethnic Russian population and Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine. So that's a challenge for Putin. And what I believe that Putin and the Kremlin fear very much is that if Zelensky succeeds, if he comes to terms with corruption in a way that, you know, all of his successors as president have not yet done, if he curbs the influence of the oligarch, if he gets the economy growing, that's a model that is going to be very worrisome for the Kremlin, because Russians are going to look and say, wait, Ukraine next door is succeeding. Why can't we have that same kind of open democratic system? And I believe at some level that really worries those in the Kremlin, and they haven't yet figured out how to deal with this challenge.
Well, just in closing, the only area where I would agree with Trump, even though he said that he wanted Russia back in the G8 because he wanted peace, and that I don't know what the exactly the peace plan is, but the fact that both that the INF treaty has literally gone out the window, and that Russia tested this nuclear-powered vessel missile that Putin had touted earlier as being the, you know, it's apparently, I mean, I know that Los Alamos, they did the tests in the 50s, I think, or the 60s, on a nuclear rocket engine, and they also deliberately blew it up, and it's really bad news, and we don't know what happened when it blew up. We know that they lost some technicians. Putin mentioned that. But nobody knows about the fallout. And various of the monitoring stations have been closed, whether they stopped monitoring it or whether they've stopped the telemetry. Nevertheless, you're also in the arms control business at Brookings. Is there any way to revive INF? I know the reasons for pulling out had a lot to do with China fielding all of these short-range missiles, and they are dangerous because they arrive at the target within about 5 minutes. So there's not a lot you can do about them except ban them.
Yeah. No, I think, unfortunately, I mean, to go back, the INF treaty is done. Unfortunately, the Russians violated the treaty. I believe the Trump administration could have done some more to try to save the treaty. But with people like National Security Advisor John Bolton, he's not a fan of arms control, and he specifically opposed the INF Treaty. So I'm not sure the Trump administration made the effort that it could have made to try to save the treaty. And it's very difficult at this point to see how you revive it. So I think in terms of arms control, the concern now is you have the new Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty, New START, which was signed back in 2010. That constrains U.S. and Russian strategic nuclear forces in a way that I would argue is very beneficial to the United States. But that treaty expires in 2021, although it can be extended for up to 5 years. Now, the Russians have several times suggested, let's have a discussion about extension. Thus far, the Trump administration has not taken up that idea. That, to my mind, is a mistake. New START extension is what I would call a no-brainer. First of all, extending New START would extend the limits on Russian strategic nuclear forces out to 2026. Second, it would ensure that the verification provisions of the treaty, the data exchanges, the notifications, and the on-site inspections where American inspectors can go and look at Russian strategic forces, those would continue for an additional 5 years, and that gives us a lot of information about Russian strategic forces. And third, we would get that at no cost to ourselves. It would not affect, extension would not affect American strategic modernization plans because those plans have been designed to fit within the New START limits. So I think now in terms of arms control, the focus should be is trying to persuade the Trump administration to extend that treaty. That would give us an additional 5 years to sort out how can we figure out the role of arms control in terms of enhancing U.S. and global security. That also may be an uphill battle.
Well, Stephen Pfeiffer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who's a non-resident senior fellow in the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative, the Center for the 21st Century Security and Intelligence, and the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. He's also the William Perry Fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the